Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Ensure your next purchase is the real deal and shop authentic handbags, watches, sneakers, streetwear, and jewelry from eBay, backed by Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
And welcome to episode 4 of Still Watching Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
And today on the podcast, we will be discussing the latest episode, episode 4, The Whole World is Watching. This week, you'll also get not one, but two interviews. That's right. We've got longtime Marvel producer Nate Moore. He's fantastic. He's worked at Marvel for a really long time, and he has a lot to say about the Marvel process and about this show specifically. And we also have Falcon and the Winter Soldier series director Kari Skoglund, who has some great stuff to say about the Zemo cut and Madripoor and a bunch of other things. So there will be back-to-back interviews before our pal Anthony Bresnikan joins us in the very end of the episode to get a little geeky about some comic book stuff. But first, we have a still-watching announcement for you. We have decided which show we're watching next. Richard, do you want to tell the people what we're watching?
Yeah, we're going back to HBO. And this young actor called Kate Winslet is in a show. It's a big break for her. Called Mayor of Easttown. There's a real Easton, Pennsylvania. This is set in Easttown, Pennsylvania. And it's a murder mystery. So we're kind of going back to like the Undoing territory where we can speculate about whodunit.
Whodunit? All right. Okay. So that's it. That episode will come out April 18th, which is a Sunday. That's when Mayor of Easttown is debuting on HBO. And then you will have a podcast episode to go with it. There will be just a couple weeks when Falcon and the Winter Soldier and Mayor of Easttown overlap. So if you're like a Marvel diehard and you're here for Marvel, don't be alarmed if you see something else in the feed. Hey, you can even join us if you want to. But we'll have sort of double episodes for a couple weeks. And then it'll just be all Mayor all the time.
And if you're a superhero fan, the great Gene Smart from Watchmen is in Mayor of Easttown. So there's
and
a ton of synergy.
Non-Quicksilver himself, Evan Peters. So
exactly. You know. Yeah. So even an even more relevant thing to this spring.
He's playing Ralph Boner, I believe is his name, in Mayor of Easttown. Anyway, that's what we're doing next. So before we get into our analysis of this episode, episode 4, Richard, do you have any emails you want to share with us?
Yeah, we got, as always, a ton of good emails, but I picked a couple that I thought would be interesting to talk about. The first one is from Kevin. He writes, am I the only one who has noticed that Baron Zemo has basically been turned into bad guy Batman? It wasn't super obvious in Civil War, the movie that he debuts in, but we did see he was motivated into action by the death of his parents. Did they wear pearl necklaces in Sokovia? And relied on his intellect to defeat people with actual powers. But episode 3 of Falcon and the Winter Soldier leaned all the way into it. Now he's wealthy with a hand-to-hand combat expert, and even has an old butler who organizes stuff for him. The only thing left is to find out his mom's name was Martha. Anyway, please tell me I'm not the only one who sees this. I see it now.
Can I echo that with another email that I was going to save to chat to Anthony about? But so Mark wrote in with this question about Zemo because he says, does the decision to reveal in Falcon the Winter Soldier that Zemo has been the wealthy baron of the comics all along undermine some of the bootstrappy ethos in Civil War, specifically that a person need only, quote unquote, experience and patience to accomplish anything? There's not much in Civil War that would explicitly slot Zemo into one wealth strata over another, aside from the vast riches it would take to travel the world, stay in fancy hotels, and procure explosives. But it seemed to me that the Russos had intentionally given him a working to middle class vibe to drive home the idea that with proper motivation, anyone could rip the Avengers apart. Doesn't giving Zemo seemingly limitless resources and a penchant for Machiavelli in Falcon the Winter Soldier kind of diminish that idea? And I liked Mark Zemo because I had always kind of thought of Zemo that way, as sort of like an ordinary man pushed to an extraordinary extreme because of personal loss. And he is definitely something, a fur collar, dancing meme, something else a little bit in this show. And I'm not mad about it, but it does feel like a different twist on the character. What do you think, Richard?
Well, he's wearing a Bane coat while kind of being Batman. I mean, we don't talk about the other side of the street on this podcast. We don't talk about DC. I mean, I think that it's funny to watch this show take a character who in Civil War, from if memory serves me, was like, kind of like you said, like a sort of serious or attempt at a serious kind of accounting of or thinking over like collateral damage of all the kind of heroic action we'd seen, you know, and there was a real weight to his villainy, which is something when I first saw that movie, I really appreciated because it didn't feel like some outside entity from afar troubling the waters for one movie and then leaving. He actually kind of was like reckoning with the whole past films, you know?
Yeah.
And I still think that's happening in this show. They have, I think for the sake of like, you know, to try to ingratiate him into the fold of the hero side of things. Yeah, they've made him a little funnier, quippier, a little more dashing, you know, with private jets and big fur coats and all that stuff. And I think, you know, maybe a little bit is lost in his characterization with that, but I think you also have Carly really emerging as a similar voice to that. And so, you know, I think we certainly saw in this episode Sam saying, "I agree with you," to Carly. And I would imagine Zemo does too. So I think that spirit is still there, even if his character has shifted a bit more into kind of Loki-esque anti-hero comic relief.
Well, Zemo would and he wouldn't, right? Because he's vehemently opposed to Super Soldier Serum. And he also has this like really interesting... It's interesting. We get two different takes on like what happens to someone when they take the Super Soldier Serum, right? Because Zemo says to Sam, like, whatever you saw that you admired in Carly, like, she's gone. And that reminded me of, like, in the world of Buffy Vampire Slayer, like, Angel versus Angelus or whatever. Like, once the demon takes over you, the human that you thought you knew is gone, right? And it's just a demon wearing their face. So that's Zemo's interpretation of the Super Soldier Serum. Lamar, rest in peace, says to John, it just enhances who you are. Power just makes a person more of themselves. And he says, you consistently make the right decision in the heat of battle. We sort of see that play out very poorly, to put it extremely mildly, at the end of this episode. But those are like sort of two different like, does the Super Soldier Serum enhance who you actually are, or does it turn you into something more monstrous? And I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, where it's like, if you have a single flaw in you And that's the beauty of Steve Rogers, is that he's a flawless diamond, right? But like, if you have a single flaw in you, it will overtake your better instincts if you take the super soldier serum. Does that make sense?
I think you meant to say flawless dime piece, right?
Sure.
No, it does make sense. And I think, you know, there have long been these questions about not just the Marvel universe, but like superheroes in general, this kind of question of like, I keep mentioning it, but sort of objectivist, ubermensch kind of ideas. Mm-hmm. And like, who actually deserves that mantle to power? I think Zemo or whoever else would argue no one. But it's kind of a little bit like alcohol. You know, people are like, in vino veritas, but also like, is that really true? Does drinking reveal who you are, or do you kind of, does it, it tease out some things but also change who you are? Mm-hmm. So I don't think that they're trying to make a reference to alcohol with super serum, but like, you know, it's that thing of like, who, what is like the id inside us, and how does it, if it were ever to manifest outwardly, what would that be? I think that this episode in particular starts to get into some, I think, genuinely interesting questions within the Marvel world of like power and, you know, extrajudicial policing and all that stuff. And judicial policing. I mean, you know, like, I think there are a lot of parallels between John's arc in this episode and policing in America.
Absolutely.
And, you know, does the badge and the gun reveal who you are, or does it provoke something new that is still, I mean, working off of something internal, but like, I don't know, I think it mutates.
Of your two metaphors there, I give the law enforcement one 5 stars and the alcohol one like 3 stars. 3 stars, except I'll add an extra 2 stars because that blue super soldier serum looks like blue Curacao, something I would never take personally.
Not since college.
Not since college, not since that one night. Sam, I think this idea of like Steve being this one in a million kind of guy, is something interesting to explore. And this idea that Sam immediately says like, no, I would not take the serum, like instantly says that when Zemo asks him. And I think it's because Sam acknowledges his own humanity. He's like, I know that I'm not Steve Rogers. I'm, it doesn't make me not great, but like, I'm not Steve Rogers, and I've got something in me, you know what I mean, that I wouldn't want to see blown up, by taking the serum. That was my interpretation sort of that. Of mm-hmm. his rejection of that. Like, he knows who he is. And it's not that he's bad or less than Steve. It's just Steve is freakishly a good person is the whole thing. So, you know.
Yeah.
All right. What other emails you got for me, Richard?
So Carla writes to us, something I've noticed in the first 3 episodes of Falcon and the Winter Soldier is that there seems to be a theme of people not recognizing Sam. So far, it's happened in every episode. The bank worker, the police officers, and the people he fooled while undercover as the Smiling Tiger. When they hear that he's Falcon, they know who that is, so it's not a case of just not knowing his famous identity. People always seem to recognize Avengers in the movies and shows, and he was an official Avenger for the same amount of time as Wanda, from the end of Age of Ultron to Civil War. And in WandaVision, the people in S.W.O.R.D. easily recognized her, even in black and white in a sitcom outfit. I wonder if this is another thing Sam has to consider if he chooses to take on the mantle of Captain America. It's a name that will make people take notice, and he would be much more recognizable to those who support him and those who are angry about a black man being Captain America. I think the issue of Sam being recognized and not recognized is definitely an intentional sort of thematic mm-hmm. pattern.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to get too far afield, but I think there, you know, the sort of disconnect between, you know, someone might say, oh, well, you know, there are black celebrities, there was a black president, so like racism is solved, you know, which kind of demands that in order to be treated as a somewhat equal member of society, you have to be like rich, famous, accomplished, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It prizes that kind of celebrity and model minority status without actually addressing the real issue pertaining to those people and everyone else. And I think that Sam is kind of existing interestingly in that duality, because he's like a, you know, maybe second string ish Avenger, who is famous for his goggles and his wings, but like out of costume is treated a certain way until people find out that he is. It's like, oh, the, you know, the scene with the police, like, oh no, you're not just a regular black man who we would have continued to treat like that.
Right.
Now we're going to stop. And I think that duality and that dichotomy is definitely, definitely deliberate.
Yeah. And you had mentioned before we started recording that I was like, was there an instance in this episode? And you pointed out the moment where John Walker gets approached for a signature and an autograph, and Battlestar doesn't. And just this idea of like, yeah, Captain America more recognizable and maybe the white hero more quote-unquote recognizable, and whatever commentary the show is trying to make about that. I think it's
well,
really interesting.
People have, have taken the time to get to know what Steve Rogers looks like, you know, they've afforded him the sort of full consideration of his humanity to like remember his fucking face. And that is not the case with Sam. And I think that's definitely, definitely pointed.
Excellent. Any other emails?
Yeah, one more. From Davey. Davey writes, I was listening to the latest episode on Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and I'd love to hear more about what you thought about Madripoor, because I had some issues watching it, that they've introduced an entirely fictional nation in Asia and decided to make it run and operated by criminals, almost like some kind of lawless area which is populated entirely by criminals. It just felt a little wrong to me, almost like an anti-Wakanda, where instead of an African utopian society, we get the worst ideas about Asia in one country, and then populate it pretty much entirely with non-Asian characters.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I had asked you about Madripoor because I thought the idea of a sort of lawless pirate city state was interesting, and hadn't really at the time thought about like all of the other implications of that. Like, they didn't set this in like an island off the coast of Australia or something, you know, like this was deliberately in Southeast Asia, and I guess has been in the comic books. And I was talking to a friend about it earlier this week, and she was like, oh yeah, that stuff is like messed up. Like, that whole idea and the execution of it is really clumsy, especially for a season of television that is aiming to be at least in some ways addressing issues of, you know, racial injustice.
Yeah, I thought the like the visuals of Madripoor were amazing, and I liked the idea of like the low city, high city. Like, I liked all of that, and especially if they're establishing it as a location that we're going to go to in the future. But it wasn't until a little later, when someone pointed out to me that it does fall into that classic genre trope of having like you oftentimes in sci-fi films and television, right, a future city will be Asian influenced. That's like a way to code futuristic into a space, and then oftentimes there are no actual Asian people in that location. The main culprit here I'm thinking of is Blade Runner, both Blade Runner films. Yeah. There was a lot of conversation around the release of Blade Runner 2046 and you know, why are there no Asian people in this very Asian city? And so, yeah, I mean, I don't have a great answer for that. I think if I had to guess about the way that they're going to use Madripoor in the future, I would say this will not be the case going forward. But I don't quite know what the thinking was in this episode. I did talk to Carrie Skoglund, the director, about the creation of Madripoor and all that went into it. So you'll hear her insights into that a little later in this episode.
And I just want to kind of head off some emails I know are going to arrive. Yes, listeners, I did just hear Joanna say Blade Runner 2046 and not 2049. And I am as appalled as you are.
Ah! Sorry. Sorry, dang it. So funny, as I was saying it, I was like, oh, I remember all the numbers. I'm just going to say them with full confidence. Oh, no. Thank you. Thank you for preventing those emails. Okay. So those are the emails that we have for this episode. You can always email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. So let us dig into the episode a little deeper. All right. Let's start with the beginning, which is Sebastian Stan. I'm sorry, crushing this opening sequence in Wakanda, where we see Bucky discover that he has been successfully deprogrammed with Io, Florence Kasumba's character. I loved it. I loved his wig, which is way better than the wig they gave him in Infinity War. I was a big fan of this moment. Richard, how did you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I like all that kind of, it's not spycraft really, but that sort of brainwashy, like the sequence of words that unlocks it. Like, there's something really sinister about all that. And I thought that getting that little flashback that had been, you know, to a time that was alluded to in some of the movies was interesting. And it nicely threaded in the kind of cliffhanger thing from last week's episode, at the end of last week's episode, to two scenes later in this episode, where these Wakandans come in and are like, going to put a stop to things, you know. And I think it positioned them interestingly as both, you know, compassionate people who are helping this wayward guy who probably many other people would have just tossed out, you know, because he was a murderer and stuff, but also as tough, capable people who will not brook too much you know, things threatening them, I guess.
Yeah, they've mentioned, you know, they keep mentioning Bucky's connection to Wakanda. And I think that I have to wonder if we're going to see him return to Wakanda, like the only place where he's felt peace and stuff like that. I don't know if that's going to be the case, but I can't remember if it was with you or with Anthony last week, but I was sort of speculating, you know, they're going to do a Wakanda Disney Plus show that I think centers a bit more on the Dora Milaje, and which would be a reason why we're getting so much from them in this series. It's another one of those ways in which Marvel is sort of like looking forward, right? Constantly spinning off into other directions. But I mean, they're fantastic in this episode. They're fantastic always, but like, I love to see them again. I love their choreography. I love that, like, when they spin the spears around their necks and like everything they do, they're amazing. They, you know, and they just absolutely cleaned up in their big fight scene. So I'm so, so happy to see them here. But like, I'm wondering, like, are we going to see Bucky in the Wakanda show? Maybe. I don't know. So, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, half of everything in a Marvel anything is an ad for the next thing, which generally I kind of roll my eyes at. But in this case, like, I definitely want to see more of that. I think, you know, the sequel to Black Panther is going to be a strange thing because of Chadwick Boseman's death, and just to see like where they take the story and who they focus on and all that. But while we wait for that sort of sad thing, happy thing too, in some ways, I think that the promise of a show that really focuses on these characters, Dora Milaje, you said, is it pronounced?
They pronounce the E at the end of Milaje, so like Milaje, like Dora Milaje.
Milaje, yeah. Okay. But I thought, you know, not only, you know, sort of doing cool fight scenes and giving us this interesting flashback at the beginning of the episode, I think there was a really crucial moment with Io, when she has really, you know, stopped John in his tracks, really kind of embarrassed him. Well, in his mind, embarrassed him. I don't think that she's thinking in those terms. And afterward, he's licking his wounds, and he says, they don't even have superpowers or whatever, you know, whatever the line is about that.
Super soldier serum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Serum.
And I think that that moment of curdled sort of shame and anger, especially about the fact that it's a black woman who did this to him, a non-American person too,
completely
is a real tipping point. And I think that that was a nice quick kind of distillation representative sort of moment of a lot of anger that we see, I think, that motivates a lot of nationalist, white nationalist people in the country, in the real world, you know, that kind of indignity of the congressman yelling, "You lie," during Obama's first State of the Union address, as if he just couldn't abide this black person having authority over him or some, you know, whatever. So I thought that was a really crucial detail to have in the episode that brought in a sort of new avenue of discourse for this character's, you know, devolution into villainy.
I completely agree. And I thought, you know, Florence Kasumba and all the actresses who were, you know, there was that really cool moment where one of the other warriors picked up the shield, and it just like, it looked great. Looked better on her, definitely.
Yeah,
looked better on her than it did on has ever looked on John Walker. But yeah, that I love that description that you had, like curdled, like petulance, and I think Wyatt Russell, you know, I'm going to give him a lot of credit. I think he's playing this part really well. It's a guy that I hate, but he's doing a great job with it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, in that way, like I was thinking about that too. Like it's, I don't want to say thankless, because I'm sure for an actor, it's an interesting thing to tuck into, but it is not at all a flattering role or performance. Right. And I think that I think we talked about it in the first episode, like even the way he looks under the mask, like there's just something sort of off about it. He's a very handsome guy, but like it just something about it like feels wrong. And mm-hmm. I think that Wyatt Russell is really leaning into that and making us see quite chillingly that there is a human being there that is sort of being taken, you know, whose like worst impulses and thoughts are sort of being brought to the fore. So it makes the villainy all that much more scary and palpable and real. That like he's just this like pathetic, entitled person. You know, he's not some like space villain with weird motivations. Like, and I think that drives where his character's headed. You know, it drives it home that much more. And I think that Wyatt Russell is a big part of that.
Let's talk about that ending really quickly. I had a rather perturbing morning before I hopped on this call with you, in that I was reading the Reddit boards as I often do, just because I usually like reading the Reddit boards because there's like a lot of like, you know, people with really deep bench of knowledge that, can point me in the direction of things that I should research and stuff like that, or, I like seeing all the questions that people are asking, so I kind of know what questions other people might be asking and stuff like that. So it's really helpful usually. This morning is a little creepy because the boards that I was looking at, they were like, John Walker did nothing wrong. And I was like, oh my God. So let's talk about this for a second. Let's talk about the ending. This really disturbing ending. This episode is called The Whole World is Watching. John Walker is caught on, you know, phone footage. After having juiced up, as we expected, he probably was going to juice up. I believe he has decapitated that guy, because there's a wide shot and the guy's chest isn't. At first, I thought he was just sort of maybe caving his chest in, just a light chest caving. But no, I think it was a decapitation. And then we see that shot of him standing tall and the blood on the shield, which is a really stunning image. And I was thinking about like, how did Steve Rogers react in a similar circumstance? So in Captain America, the First Avenger, I mean, we know he's no Steve Rogers, but in Captain America, the First Avenger, there are two instances where Steve like could have gone buck wild if he wanted to. One is when Erskine dies, like right after he gets the super soldier serum, handsome Hydra spy Richard Armitage, kills Stanley Tucci's Erskine. And then there's this big chase through the city. And I rewatched that this morning, and like what Steve does is he dives underwater because Richard Armitage gets into like a little submarine boat thing. He dives underwater, he pulls him out, and then he pulls him out of the water. And he's sort of like, who are you working for? And then Armitage, activates a cyanide capsule in his tooth and dies that way. But Steve didn't kill him, right? And then later when Bucky dies, Bucky falls off the train and Steve had just knocked out a guy with his shield who a Hydra guy is right inside the train by Steve. And Steve could have turned and taken his full anguish out on that guy, but he doesn't. He just cries for Bucky. He's just incapacitated with sorrow. And then the last sort of parallel is in Civil War when Steve is fighting Tony and with Bucky, and Tony takes Bucky's arm off, and Steve sort of beats him down and then stands over him and has the shield above him. And there is this moment where you're like, is Steve Rogers going to kill Tony Stark? And then he just brings it down on the, like, on the arc reactor powering the suit, and just powers him down and drops the shield and walks away. And just thinking about all those moments and who Steve is and how he reacts and how John Walker reacts here, there's zero justification. I mean, just in case anyone listening here was writing on that Reddit board this morning, there's zero justification for what John Walker did to a man who was on his back and surrendering, do you know? So
right.
Anyway, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. And I think the point maybe that the show is making in this episode about all that is like, Steve was a rare kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that, like, most people, if given that kind of thing, would be more like John.
Do you think so? Okay, that's what some people on the boards are saying, and I, okay.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That we're supposed to agree with, you know, that we're supposed to be like, well, and he was right to do. I think they're saying that, like, this is such a tenuous power that... Yeah. Most people who are not sort of like freakishly decent like Steve is would abuse it. And I think, you know, about that, the I guess decapitation scene, which was not at all, you know, a proportionate response or whatever, is, you know, everyone standing around filming it and looking sort of horrified to see Captain America do this incredibly violent, vindictive thing. Some of that surprise and I think drama is coming from this idea of like, well, here is a lot of what America does just sort of nakedly exposed on camera. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think it feels less like, I can't believe that John Walker just took it to this next level. I think it's more the next level has already existed and it's just now being seen kind of nakedly in this very like, you know, representative way. And yeah, so I think I don't agree that he was justified in doing that, but I do think that they're sort of making an argument that he is not at all alone in doing that.
There is earlier in the episode, John says to the Dora Milaje, the Dora Milaje have no jurisdiction here. And the question is what jurisdiction, this is something some of our listeners were sort of batting around this morning in a message board that I saw, but like, what jurisdiction does Captain America have in Latvia? And like partially the answer is he's working with the GRC, this like global entity, right? We saw him come out of a GRC van. Like, we know he's working with them. So in theory, he does have some sort of like jurisdiction there. But at the same time, it is, you know, I would agree with anyone who would say so, a very American attitude to assume jurisdiction abroad. And deny other people jurisdiction abroad. Do you know what I mean? So.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. The additional pain of that final moment there, is that flag smasher had earlier in the episode told Carly that, you know, he had been a fan of Captain America growing up. And then Captain America kills him. I will say the flag smashers, I'm having trouble really latching onto them. Part of it, I think, is because we keep meeting new lieutenants briefly. Like, we met a different lieutenant briefly last week, and he's in this episode, but we're supposed to be focusing on this guy whose name is Nico, by the way, who dies. But we have only had like one scene with him, and then he dies. And I think it would just be a little bit stronger if we knew these flag smashers other than Carly a bit better than we do. There is a rumor that, well, part of the original scripts, there was going to be like a virus plot line with the flag smashers. In fact, like the production company behind Falcon the Winter Soldier was called Pandemic Productions. Not kidding. That happened before COVID. And then they scrapped it entirely, and you can see why. But I have to wonder if maybe some of the Flag Smasher story got lost in scrapping that whole sort of biological weapon part of the series.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
But yeah, they're just... yeah. Anyway. All right. So let us talk about... Well, I want to circle back on something you said about Zemo and how they're making him more like dashing and all this sort of stuff and fun and the stuff with the Turkish Delight. The thing with Zemo, though, is that I think this show is trying to lull us into a false sense of security around him. Right? Because here's what's really important to remember. He said in last week's episode, like, I don't mean to leave my work unfinished, meaning eradicating the super soldier serum. We saw him gleefully stomping on vials of blue curacao in this week's episode. And that leaves a couple things left. That leaves John Walker. That leaves the Flag Smashers. That leaves Bucky, as Sam points out. And that leaves Isaiah Bradley. And all of those people, I think, are in danger from Zemo. Because however nice he's been playing, he has one ideology that it reigns supreme for him, and that is the eradication of the super soldier serum and anyone who has taken it. So, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that, about Zemo and what he might be up to?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some other I mean, I think the joke about, like, did he just go El Chapo on us or whatever? Like they're recognizing that there is a whole other thing afoot here that we're not, at least right now, privy to. And I'm kind of curious, because I think that this episode, you know, especially this scene between, this kind of long dialogue scene between Sam and Carly, was about people on, you know, arguably different sides of things, but kind of realizing they're not. It was about sort of seeing that sort of closeness in ideology and starting maybe to bond against the bigger threat of, you know, imperialist might. And I just will be curious to see where Zemo factors into that, because again, I kind of think that Sam and everyone is more aligned in some ways with what Zemo thinks than they are now with what the sort of this agent of the US government does. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be like a tidy, you know, we're friends now ending.
I think there's also some really interesting parallels that they're trying to draw between, like, as much as John Walker is different from Steve, the way in which Sam is similar to Steve, obviously, you know, they're not exactly the same, but the empathy that he has for Carly and the reminder to us that Sam was, you know, did like group therapy for veterans, that was his job. That's how we met him in Winter Soldier. And something that I think is interesting is that in Endgame, after like in the midst of the snap of the blip, Steve is working as a sort of grief counselor, sort of taking on what Sam did. And so I just like that return to that as a really nice link between the two of them. Like this empathy, this desire to see things from others' point of view, that Sam definitely has running through him, you know?
Well, right. Yeah, exactly. And like, that is such a, you know, if anyone is going to do this ridiculous thing and dangerous thing, they should at least have that, you know, a capacity for some empathy.
What do you make of in this show that is so specific about how it's talking about race in America and elsewhere? What do you make of the death of Battlestar Lamar in this episode?
I was thinking about that, and I don't know how complicated the show is trying to be in that sort of, like, what that means, but like this sense that Sam was, I think it's fair to say, at least in the terms of the movies, a sort of sidekick to Steve. And it's never talked about in the movies, to my recollection, about like, but like Steve, you know, this shining white Aryan, you know, defender of freedom, having a black man by his side could, in as much as Captain America has been a propaganda tool, like a sort of sign of like, see, look, no, like everything is inclusive. And then Steve leaves and gets old and whatever. And then Sam doesn't get the gig, even though he kind of turns it down. And then they hire someone exactly like, well, at least appearance wise, like Steve. And then they just kind of reiterate that by giving him this. I mean, I don't know if the government gave him the sidekick, but like, you know, and then to have that guy die really unceremoniously and suddenly, and just like, you know, I think it was kind of talking a little bit metatextually about the flimsiness of that trope of sort of showing a white character's decency by having them be adjacent to a person of color, even though that person of color really never gets their own sort of primacy or agency in the storytelling in the way that the white character does. And so I think there was some sort of like reckoning or recognizing of that sort of, you know, very problematic tradition of, you know, in movies happening there. I don't know. Am I like overreaching?
No, I think that's really interesting. I really liked the Lamar character.
Yeah.
And I thought he had such tremendous presence in the series, and I was actually really surprised that this happened. And this is kind of a classic fridging. And at first I was like, when he first hit the pillar, I was like, no way would they do that to this character. I just didn't believe that that's what was happening, and then it was. And I don't know. I think I'm still processing it, but I'm curious if people want to write in stillwatchingpod@gmail.com their thoughts on that moment. I'd love to hear it, because I think I'm still trying to figure out how I feel about it.
Yeah. And I think that people could probably, dig into it more thoughtfully than I just did. I mean, I think it's partly just a simple storytelling tool of like, he needed this final kick in, you know, to get him into this new villainy arc or whatever. But I think there is more there. I think it was loaded from the get-go that they were paired up in a similar way to Steve and Sam, with, you know, the black man in second position. And, you know, I think there's something deliberate happening there.
I think that's right. I do. All right. Is there anything? I mean, I think this is like a really chilling, disturbing episode. Everything still feels like a little jangly to me in this series. But something that you'll hear in my interview with Nate Moore is he talks about how episode 5, he feels next week's episode, really brings everything together. So I'm really interested to see how everything sort of fits, you know, neatly together. Anything else you want to say about this episode, Richard?
Well, it's technically about last week's episode, but they they put it in the previously on. When Sam says it, I think, they're in Riga, a city on the Baltic Sea. These people would know where Latvia is and what its capital is. They don't need to say that. These are globetrotting, you know, super people. Like, I just find that line sort of, maybe I just because I like forced myself 15 years ago to like learn all the capitals of Europe for some reason, because I was bored one day at work. But like, I don't know, that line just I think is funny. I think it's interesting that this whole episode takes place in Latvia.
Well, as a globetrotting super person myself, I completely agree with you. I mean, I know where Latvia is, so I thought that was a really odd line, but it, you know, it was cool. The locations that they had in this episode were really cool, and you know, you'll hear that in both the interviews I do. Actually, they talk about their insistence on like shooting globally versus trying to fake going abroad. Do you know what I mean? So let's get into my interview with Nate Moore first. I just want to give some context for folks who don't know. Nate has been at Marvel since like almost the very beginning. He was brought on to manage something called the Writers Program that they had, you know, back in the day, where you got the genesis of Guardians of the Galaxy and Black Panther. He was moved into sort of a bigger producing role as his time at Marvel went on, and he, you know, he is the main producer on Black Panther. And on this show. And so, he has a lot to say about Marvel and how it works. And he's a true joy. He's part of something that's called the Parliament at Marvel, which is a really fun, like, I don't know, it sounds kind of Illuminati at the same time, but really fun. He's part of like, I think it's like 7 people who are called the Parliament at Marvel, and he's one of them. So let us hear from the great Nate Moore.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
So when do you recall when you were first aware that Falcon the Winter Soldier was something that Marvel wanted to do?
Yeah, it was pretty early on, honestly. We had seen their chemistry both on and off set on Civil War, which I was got to be a part of, and it was amazing. In that, Mackie and Sebastian ages hit it off, and I think brought out different colors in each other that weren't necessarily expected, both as people and performers. And so we knew there was something special there. And when Disney Plus began to be a real idea, it was one of the first things we pitched as like, we should do this as a show. And not because we had the idea of exactly what it was, but because we knew those two characters would play so well off each other that there'd be just sort of a natural chemistry. And television is so much more about characters than it is about plot anyway, frankly, that we didn't feel like, oh, we needed a big plot to hang the show on. We actually just needed a really good character dynamic that we could build upon. And I think the truth is the three first shows that are coming out were the three first ideas we had was Wanda and Vision. Cause oh my gosh, there's so much there, both even in publishing, I would say more so Sam and Bucky, Falcon Winter Soldier, and then Loki for different reasons. Loki, if you've ever been to a Comic-Con where Tom Hiddleston makes an appearance, you just sort of see what magic that is. So we weren't three for three and like, they're so great, but we were three for three. And the first three things we wanted to do were the first three things we did. But yeah, Sam and Bucky was a product really of Sebastian and Mackie, you know?
Can you describe that? You say we pitched, are you pitching to the powers that be at Disney? Who's doing the pitching and something like that?
Yeah, it's Kevin and Lou and Victoria going to Iger, frankly, and the Disney Plus team and saying, oh, we understand you'd like us to do shows. What about these shows? And I, you know, our relationship with Disney has been really interesting over the years in that they have really allowed us to take the lead creatively as to what we want to do. They've never said you should do this or you shouldn't do that. So in pitching the show, they go, great. Like that's, if you guys are excited, let's go make those shows. And that, I think in a good way, puts the onus on us to make sure those shows are good because, man, what better supportive partners could we have? We don't want to let them down by delivering a show that doesn't, you know, better the promise of what we've talked to them about in the room.
Right, right. And I've talked to both Malcolm Spellman and Jack Schaefer at this point about what a head writer is on one of these shows.
Yeah.
But I'm really curious about your role. And I know that in the Marvel movie machine, there is, you know, an assigned producer that's with, mm-hmm. you know, the project. And I know you've played that role before. And I'm mm-hmm. wondering if there's a difference between playing that role in the movie universe versus the TV universe.
It's actually pretty similar, but I would say I have less knowledge going into TV than I did in films, you know. And one of the great things about Malcolm is he was so versed in how television was built from the ground up in ways, frankly, that I don't know and I still could learn a ton, that even though I understood the story in the broader sense of what we wanted to tell and how it could fit into the other things in the MCU and even the legacy of the characters, because I'd been on Winter Soldier and Civil War, I didn't know how to break a television show. And so for me, it was a bit of an education to sit with Malcolm and his team and figure out, oh, like that's the rhythm. Oh, that's interesting. Cause my lizard brain just goes to, oh, it's just a long movie.
Right.
But Malcolm's like, yeah, you can't do that. Like, there's no 6-hour movie for a reason. It won't sustain that way. You have to figure out the rhythms of the episode.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, I like to think I got to be kind of a sounding board and creative partner for Malcolm, but it was definitely me learning more than I was teaching.
In terms of being sort of that bridge between Kevin, Victoria, and Lou and the head writer, what does that look like to you almost day to day?
Yeah, it's, you know, I've been at Marvel now for 11 plus years, so I kind of have a pretty good understanding of what's going to get them excited, of things they might find problematic, and places where we can stretch that don't seem intuitive. Because I think for Malcolm, coming into a place like Marvel, he has a lot of preconceived expectations about how it works and what he'll be able to do, and can I do this, and are they going to let us do anything like that? And the truth is, there's probably a lot more latitude than it may seem like from the outside. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of me being a security blanket for Malcolm saying, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, I know you think that might seem controversial on the face of it because we haven't done it. But this isn't the team to not do something because we haven't done it. This is actually the team that goes, oh, we haven't done that. Let's try that. I think it was freeing for him to have somebody in the room every day who we could go, is that going to fly or not going to fly? And typically it was, yeah, that's going to fly if we can make it great. And I do think then the pressure was less about how do I convince Marvel and just how do I make a good show? And I think that was helpful for Malcolm. At least I hope so.
Yeah. And I imagine it saves a lot of time. You know, you hear a lot of head writers or showrunners, which is a different position, at other TV studios, you know, having to toss out a bunch of things once they get network notes, and you're skipping that process where you have someone in the room who's like, I'm pretty sure I know what they're going to like, what they're not going to like.
Yeah.
We don't even need to bother going down that road, you know?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I do think we did get to skip some pitfalls because of that. Now, the truth is at Marvel, we are also notorious for like the, you know, eighth inning curveball. And this show is no different, but I think one of the ways that it works, or at least doesn't completely frustrate creative people, is that we're in it with them. We don't go, here's a curveball. Good luck. I hope you hit it. It's like, okay, curveball's coming, Malcolm. Let's huddle up and let me help you figure out how to crack this curveball, which again, I think helped Malcolm take the pressure off himself and go, okay, well, this is just a problem we're going to solve together, and not like, oh, they've dumped a problem in my lap and left.
Right.
Like, that's, I think, such a different position to put a writer in.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I've heard with Falcon and Winter Soldier is there was a desire to make it as cinematic as possible, more cinematic.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, you know, given the 3 episodes we've seen so far, so what are some of the elements that you feel like make this a cinematic television experience?
Yeah, a lot of it was a push to go on location as much as possible, which had its own ups and downs because it's pretty well chronicled. We were meant to go to Puerto Rico before the first and second earthquake hit, so we had to pivot. And then obviously it was compounded when COVID hit and it started to restrict where we could go.
Yeah.
But if you look at a lot of television shows, you know, you end up, for instance, being in the same set a lot because you kind of have to just build, you know, the Red Keep, and you got to go to the Red Keep every week because, man, you just spent a lot of money building the Red Keep.
So much.
Yeah. And you have to figure out how much you can stand to move from place to place and let the story tell you where you want to go versus having to write towards, well, I got to go back to headquarters.
Right.
And Falcon and Winter Soldier could have been a headquarters show, I would argue, but we were able, again, hopefully in a way that feels effective and feels big, to not restrain the storytelling in that way so that it could go globetrotty as much as, again, was possible without having to always justify coming back and going to see the chief, for lack of a better analogy. Right.
Well, and it's interesting to me. You mentioned that you've been in Marvel for 11 years. I know you've progressed through various things, the writer's program, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering, one of the things that's so fascinating about Marvel is that consistency of the producers, which helps that consistency of the projects across the board, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you can talk at all about your journey, I don't know, for lack of a better term, up through the ranks of Marvel to where you are now.
Yeah, when I joined Marvel at the top of 2010, they brought me in to run the writers program because I had a lot, ton of experience in development at other companies. And Marvel was not, I would argue, still is not a company that was planned in how it came together. It kind of just came together, right? It was sort of the people who made Iron Man 1 became the cornerstone of what Marvel would become as a company. Yeah. And for me, it was almost the reverse. I didn't have a ton of production experience. I just had a ton of development experience. And so in running the writers program, I was able, I think, to turn notes around and to really hopefully help those writers see the light of day and their projects a bit faster, you know. But it's interesting in that Marvel, I would argue, takes chances on people more than other places. And I say that because, you know, I was pitching, I remember going to retreat and I was pitching Guardians of the Galaxy because Nicole had done a ton of work and it was really good and it was really exciting. And ultimately Nicole would go on to write the movie. So it was great. But at the end of that retreat, Kevin said, look, I'm going to take you off of Guardians because I need somebody to produce Captain America 2. And Steven, who produced the first one, is not available. So you're doing it. Now, that's kind of crazy. I have zero produced credits. Mm-hmm. I have a ton of development experience. Never hired a director. Like, I've never been in charge of a project. But it is sort of the Marvel way to say, hey, we believe in you. We're not going to let you sink. And here's your movie. Go to town. And that is the experience of, I would argue, every producer who's ever made a Marvel film. At one point, they were untested, hadn't done a film. And they said, here's your giant blockbuster, kid. Go make that movie. And that sort of learning on the fly, it's sort of, to go back to the Disney Plus thing, if yeah. somebody puts that trust into you, you're going to kill yourself to make that movie good because you don't want to invalidate that trust. So yeah. when I went to Cleveland with the Russo brothers on Winter Soldier, a thing I'd never done before, like I was killing myself. I was working weekends. I was up all night, like trying to make it as good as I could because I didn't want to betray the trust they put in me. And that trickles down, I think. Like everybody, I think even to some degree in casting and filmmakers, like everybody's been entrusted with this great thing. By people who really do believe in them and people who are going to do everything they can to make sure you don't fail.
Yeah.
You're probably not going to let them fail. You know what I mean? We're not one of 80 movies on a slate. All of our movies are one of one. Right. And you have your producer there who's going to be with you every step of the way because I don't want to fail. I don't want this first Disney Plus show to not work. So right. I'm going to be in there with Malcolm as much as he needs me to be there. And that's the attitude of the studio. And I think it's a very stressful environment to work because you don't want to fail, but it's a very healthy environment to work because you know that success is possible because they want you to succeed.
You mentioned Guardians coming out of the writers program. Of course, also Black Panther came out of the writers program, and this is a project that you were very closely associated with.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, did your role change at all at the company once Black Panther was such a smashola hit?
Not really. That's the other thing about the company. There's not a lot of room for ego because there's so much work to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And certainly Black Panther, I couldn't be more proud of and was very lucky to be a part of it. Wasn't the highest grossing movie we've ever made. You know what I mean? It's not like there was Avengers. Like, so you don't, there's very little resting on laurels and there's maybe too little celebration of the accomplishment because you're thrust into the next mm-hmm. thing. You know, Panther was released, but I was looking for writers for Falcon and Winter Soldier and Eternals at the same time. So there wasn't really a victory lap. And that's okay. Like from at least my personality, that's kind of better. Like I want to throw myself into the work and there's plenty of work to be had. But it didn't change. My role is the same, you know, my function on movies are the same. Mm-hmm. I'm in Atlanta right now prepping the second movie. It's the same in a way that I find really healthy and really grounding.
Is there something that Malcolm said to me that I thought was both so interesting and also not something that I had fully grasped is this idea of it's a big difference if you're telling a story about Black heroes in Wakanda and telling a story about Black heroes in America. American mm-hmm. era, Black experience is so different. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the differences you see there and what you're hoping this show accomplishes.
Yeah, I he's exactly right. I mean, and it's interesting in that it was something I probably hadn't thought a lot about until Ryan Coogler joined Panther, right? Mm-hmm. Because here's a Black hero, but as an African hero. And one of the first things Ryan brought to that project was the strong desire to have Eric Killmonger as the African-American point of view. Because he goes, look, Africa's great, and T'Challa's going to be fantastic, and Wakanda's going to be great. I want it to be a conversation about Black people in America who feel disenfranchised from their past. Because to be Black in America is different than being African. And I think Malcolm's exactly right. This Sam Wilson is an African American or Black hero. He's not an African hero. He's not T'Challa. His experience is different. You know, think about T'Challa's sort of, T'Challa was raised in a society that was African, where he was celebrated, where he could be the prince. And that's not, it wasn't overcoming a bunch of odds to be the prince. Like, there was going to be an African prince in Wakanda, always. There only ever had been.
Right.
Sam Wilson is coming from a society that was built primarily on the back of slavery and slavery of Africans who were unwillingly brought to America. So the Black experience is completely different. So success in America is defined completely differently because, as we all know, we've had one Black president and that was a big deal. And there was a big backlash as soon as he was out of office. Like Sam yep. Wilson sees the world in just a different way. And even though he came from Louisiana to working class parents and rose up through the ranks of the military, he also left the military voluntarily. Right. Like he has a very complicated relationship with the country
yeah.
that's always sort of been a part of the fabric of the movies even, but because he's never been the main character, has never really been examined. So I think the show gets to examine that in a way that, especially in light of the very tragic things that we're going through visibly as a country, even though it's always been happening, yeah. feels even more timely because holy shit, like what the show is talking about is couldn't be more in our faces now, or at least for those people who don't experience that daily.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned things that, you know, Malcolm may have not been sure that Disney or Marvel would want to do. And you're sort of like, no, let's try it. You know, when did the idea to put Isaiah Bradley and that storyline into the show come about?
That was Malcolm. He said, I want to do this. What's your feeling about this? I know it was a controversial comic. And I said, that would be great. Isaiah Bradley's amazing. I'd read Truth, Red, White, and Red, Black, and Blue a long time ago. I didn't think the comic was great, but I thought the idea was great, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I think Malcolm was very smart in figuring out how to anchor that story into the overall fabric of the show, which is really about legacy, right? It's about what is the legacy of Cap's shield and kind of America. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I think if there is an overarching theme or idea of the show, it wants to interrogate that. And is that legacy for everyone? And everybody's going to see that legacy differently. Yeah. And Isaiah Bradley, in the MCU version, which Carl Lumley has done a fantastic job on, is such a more vocal participant in that conversation than he was in the books because he was a vegetable and was infantilized and sort of had all the agency taken out of him.
Yeah.
Malcolm gave him all the agency back. And so now here's a character who can actually have a conversation about what the show is about and really weigh in on the things that I think are subconscious, probably in Sam's character. Isaiah gets to make them conscious and gets to bring them out. And I think that's such an important character and more to come. But I think that's why the Isaiah Bradley inclusion was so great. And again, all credit goes to Malcolm for really advocating for that.
Malcolm has said that episode 5 is the one that he is sort of most excited or anticipating mm-hmm. people's reactions to. Is that how you feel as well?
Yeah. Episode 5, I think, gets to bring a lot of the threads that maybe felt disparate or not fully formed together. Okay. So you sort of get to see, again, the conversation the show is going to try to have with the audience. I think episode 4 is going to be a lot of people's favorite episodes for some action reasons and some big character turns. Mm-hmm. But 5, I think, really gets to be the culmination of the theme. You know, and I do think it's both from an acting standpoint, from a filmmaking standpoint, I think is our strongest episode.
Something that I've heard people talk about in terms of this show and in sort of what Marvel is doing now is this idea of really diving into who gets to be a hero. This is something that Marvel is actively investigating right now. But, you know, given how long Black Panther was gestating at Marvel, sort of what does it feel like to you to finally see these projects that were sort of in the works for so long, conversations, heroes you wanted to do, finally, you know, get to have their moment in the sun?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's great. I think it's a long time coming, and it's not just the show. It's not just WandaVision. It's Ms. Marvel. It's She-Hulk. It's these characters who, again, I would argue have been a big component to the publishing history, but because of the way that Hollywood oftentimes evaluates properties' worthiness of being made or not made, they were overlooked, you know? Yeah. And the truth is, these stories are universal, even though they're specific. I think the more specific your story, the more universal it gets to be, because people I think we underestimate the amount of empathy people have for others as mm-hmm. filmmakers sometimes. And you go, unless it looks like the audience, they're not going to buy it. And I think that's 100% wrong and undersells what we as humans are capable of feeling. And now we're finally getting to tell stories that are specific to other cultures or genders or subcultures or international cultures. And they're as universal as ever, not because the world is so different, but because people are over-indexing on the thing we think they don't have, which is empathy. Yeah. You know, so as storytellers, we haven't been doing our jobs, and we haven't been serving people what they actually want, which is just really good stories that are specific and that are emotional and that are dramatic and that are happy and that are fun, but that can look like just about anything, because ultimately we're all human. Yeah. You know, so it's been gratifying. I think the last 10 years, you know, it was harder in the beginning. A, we just also weren't that making as much content, so there was right. less room. And now that we're having these avenues, I love that we're just running at it and saying, okay, well, being a hero is for everyone, and let us show you the wide variety of heroes, both on Disney Plus and features with Shang-Chi, with Eternals, with Black Widow, with all the things we're doing. I just think it's just the beginning. I really do.
You talked about, you know, the increase in content that Marvel mm-hmm. is doing right now. And something that, you know, for those of us who are maybe a little too invested in what's happening at Marvel, we think we can see the threads shooting out from one project into another, right?
Yeah, so sure.
if you watch the end of Endgame, you can see how those sort of vignettes right at the end are directly launching into Disney Plus shows, right? Uh-huh. Wanda's moment, Sam, Bucky, and Cap and the Shield. And then, you know, watching WandaVision, you can see how that can launch into Captain Marvel 2 or you know, like all this other mm-hmm. stuff. You can see the thread shooting out. So when it comes to this great balancing act and all these like plates you have spinning, how much is that awareness of where you have to launch forward from a does this question make sense? Where you have to launch forward, like how does that interact with the main story you want to tell?
The truth is it's probably more fluid than it seems. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that it works, if it works at all, is that all of us as filmmakers and producers and writers are open to including a new idea because, man, that's a great idea, or throwing an idea out, even if that might have a ripple downstream, if that makes sense. So, you know, characters like Monica Rambeau, for instance, weren't necessarily in the first iteration of WandaVision, but as that team started to think about, oh, wouldn't it be cool if a character did this thing? All of a sudden you go, oh, you know, it would be great. Monica Rambeau. Mm-hmm. And then you get to have this fun handoff where you go, hey, other movie that maybe has that character in it now. We have this character. Do you want to use this character? Oh yeah. Heck yeah. Like let's figure out how to work her in. So there is a flexibility that isn't prescriptive, which I think makes it work, because what we've not ever really done is said, this person has to be in your show. So figure it out. Mm-hmm. It's usually like make your show. Oh, who's in that? Oh, you're going to put that person in there. Now we can make hay over here. Mm-hmm. And to have that kind of flexibility, and for all of us as a team to be willing to take a ball, to take the handoff and go, cool handoff, I don't know what it means, but let me go run with it, I think speaks to the cohesiveness of the creative team. And sometimes they're hard conversations. Like I can remember, for instance, and this is a small thing, but I think speaks to it, in Civil War, we needed a big thing to sort of escalate that airport fight. And me as a big nerd was like, hey, wouldn't it be great if Ant-Man turned to Giant Man? Mm-hmm. Now, the truth is, then I had to go to the Ant-Man 2 producer and go like, hey, we're going to turn him into Giant Man. And Brad was like, but that was going to be a big moment in Ant-Man 2. And I was like, and then it's the conversation of where is there more value for the audience? Like, where would the audience? And it was such a good moment that ultimately Brad goes, yeah, I get it, man. Like, go do it. I'll figure out something else. And again, it's only because we work together forever and we all know each other and like each other and have been on either side of that conversation.
Yeah.
That kind of sharing of ideas and being willingness to be flexible is just a fabric of the company. So it really is neat, and it's both less planned than you think it is, but ultimately can feel really planned, because as long as everyone else embraces an idea, it's going to feel organic because we're going to try to sell it to you that way, you know?
Yeah. And this is the last question I have. And this is the one that you may or may not want to respond to. But, as you all at Marvel headquarters may have seen with WandaVision, speculation runs rampant, right? With these projects. And I know it's Marvel's policy to not comment on any speculation. You know, that's definitely your policy. I did want to raise this one just because I've been seeing this and it makes me a little nervous, which is that a lot of people think because, Wakanda enters, Florence Kasumba enters the scene at the end of episode 3, that they can expect a T'Challa, Chadwick Boseman cameo. For me, I feel like that's not something that you guys would just drop on an audience.
I can say like that is not going to happen. That is not going to happen. And okay. And I would be honest if it was that, like Chad's passing is a whole life thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I loved the guy as much as the character. And I think we have to be very careful and thoughtful about when he appears, because he meant so much to a lot of people as much as he meant to us. But yeah, we wouldn't use that as a
surprise.
Come next week, maybe you'll see Panther like right. That. We wouldn't. So he's not, and we never intended for him to be. So no, we will not see T'Challa in the Falcon Winter Soldier.
Thank you. That's the answer I was hoping for. All right. Since I do have technically 4 more minutes, I'm going to squeeze one last question in for you, which is Zemo's one of my favorite villains because he's I love a villain with a really human motivation behind, not just like I want to rule the world, but like something more interesting than that. This show is playing a lot with those kinds of villains which is something Malcolm said to me. So I'm wondering in your view, what makes a great Marvel villain?
The greatest Marvel villains are villains who have an emotional reason for what they're doing that you and I would call reasonable. Mm-hmm. I never think it works, even just as a fan. Like, to your point, any villain who wants to take over the world, I go, why? Like, yeah. I can't imagine what kind of emotional trauma causes that. But if you can really think about what is making a villain tick and it feels like something that you and I would go like, yeah, I could see that. Those are the best villains. So Killmonger, really interesting, right? Because you go, I get it. Carly Morgenthau. Yeah. I get it, man. Like it's playing out in our everyday lives, you know? Yeah. Thanos, I get it. Like, yeah, there's a problem. You know what I mean? They're all rooted in issues and emotions that are of our world. I think it's so much easier to make those characters great than villains that seem a little like I don't want to dinger on villains, but like ego, like I kind of don't get it. Like I kind of don't get his deal. So I think Kurt Russell's great. I think it looked fantastic. I don't really get it emotionally. There's nothing emotional for me to invest in. And I think when we can figure out what those emotional anchors are, that again, if the movie were made differently, they would be the heroes. Those are the best films.
Okay, that was the incredible Mr. Nate Moore. And now you will hear me speak with director Kari Skoglund, who directed all 6 episodes of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. She's had a huge career directing some of the biggest shows that are out there. Boardwalk Empire, Handmaid's Tale, Walking Dead, etc. She's such a pro, and it was such a joy to talk to her. So here is our conversation with Kari.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
I wanted to start by asking you, you know, I've spoken to Malcolm Spellman. I also spoke to the head writer and director of WandaVision. I spoke to Nate Moore actually earlier this week about the Marvel TV process and how it's different from other television shows. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about, you know, your pitching process, about being involved in the writer's room and how that's different from what you've done elsewhere in your CV.
Well, you know, I've been involved in lots of writers' rooms, so the nature of what that was wasn't different. Mm-hmm. What was a bit different, and really appreciated on my side, was that I was brought in at that stage. So I was in the writers' room from, like, when I arrived, we didn't have any scripts. So I was brought into the writers' room where I was, you know, my ideas, Malcolm was terrific at embracing some of my ideas, and there was a lot of dialogue back and forth, so that, you know, my thoughts were also baked into the DNA of the show, which meant that as I left the writer's room, I could go on, and as the scripts were coming in, I could move on, and work on the pre-production side, knowing the DNA of the scripts. So, and knowing what was discussed in the room and the genesis of an idea, and how it could be morphed or changed if necessary. So it was, I think, really helpful for all of us to be able to, you know, put our signature on the work. And for, you know, Malcolm, for me to understand what Malcolm was thinking, and what the other writers were thinking, just, you know, even as an idea was being born, and how I could help steer it perhaps to be more production friendly or more cinematic, or in ways from the director's eye, performance potentials, those sorts of things, all became very collaborative, which was unusual for the director to be on the, when doing television, unusual for the director to be in the room, not unheard of, but certainly unusual. And it was great. I really loved that.
I'm really curious, you know, so much of this show has to do with, I think I would say, the fragility of the American dream, or the fictions of the American dream, or who does the American dream belong to? And I'm curious, you know, since you're a Canadian, if it's easier to sort of analyze that from outside, outside the room looking in, and being able to see, point out some of the cracks that are in that narrative.
Well, I'm also American, and both my daughters were born in the States, so I feel like I have a foot in both worlds.
Uh-huh.
In my past work, I've done, I've looked at, for example, the troubles in Northern Ireland, possibly because I grew up in Canada. I feel a little like Switzerland. It's quite possible, you know, that we have a different way of looking at community in Canada, and looking at social I want to say social conscience, but also social responsibility to each other.
Mm.
It's much more socialist versus individualist, I suppose, if that's right. The way to put it in the States. I think having lived in the States for many years, I've really come to admire and embrace the U.S. sensibility and the willingness to embrace change as much as fight it, you know, but to have the dialogue about it. I think most important to all of this conversation is democracy. And I think that was at the core of particularly this show, and where we were sitting within the zeitgeist of the moment, and where we are sitting now, you know, politically, after Trump is no longer in the White House and Biden's coming in, and how we're starting to reflect on a period where democracy came under a different kind of lens,
yeah,
and scrutiny. And so I don't know. I think I was incredibly fortunate to come from enough of a European style background that I could be open to alternative ideas, I suppose, and perhaps embrace that in my thought process, which then, you know, helped us in guiding this conversation that we were having about democracy within democracy and borders and imperialism. All of these themes were being discussed within the narrative of this show. And because I've also done so much work in Europe, I think I'd like to say I brought to the party that sensibility because we were an international thriller.
Right.
And we needed to bring that to the room. And so I've spent a lot of time in Europe. And so I really could speak to what that perspective was about the U.S. and the sort of imperialist kind of qualities the U.S. presents to the outside world.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, like there's so many real world locations in this show, but there's also the fictional location of Madripoor, which is a dazzling, in my view, fulfillment of this location
great.
That
I'm glad we
you dazzled me. A location I'm familiar with from the comics, and it was so fun to see it come to life. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about you know, what you were trying to accomplish with Madripoor.
Well, Madripoor has to be a lawless place. And we had lots of conversations about how big or small or you know, because we were drawing from the comics, obviously, but we were not duplicating.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did draw, you know, a little bit from the skyline and we drew what we felt would be relevant to our show. So we created this idea that it was an island with one way in and one way out. You know, how would you, if you were a lawless place, how would you secure a lawless place? You'd make sure that there were not very many ways in or out, so that you could control things. We wanted it to have an upper town and a lower town, only because, which actually came out of early conversations before it was Madripoor, which just had to do with them having to go to a place that was much more dangerous than another place that was dangerous in a different way, because it was full of wealthy criminals versus more street level criminals. And then once we got into Madripoor, but we did a, you know, a high town and a low town, and tried to imagine what that was. So it was a long process. I want to say that took us probably close to, Ray Chan and I talked about it. Ray Chan is the production designer who did mm-hmm. an amazing job. We talked about that for probably 6 months before all the plans were finalized and what it was down to the minutia of, you know, was there like the power broker, the painting on the wall,
yeah,
in episode 3.
Yeah.
You know, where, how pervasive was that? Where was Dr. Nagel's place going to be, that it could be, you know, easily hidden? What hadn't we seen before? All these things, right? So I'd like to think, and I'm thrilled that you used the word dazzled, because we definitely we're trying. And I have to say, the idea of the bikes leading, I did a whole presentation of what I thought Madripoor could be with video and imagery and stuff, because, of course, you can't just dream up Madripoor. I had to have a kind of a visual document to be able to say to everybody, including all the Marvel folks, this is how we've imagined it.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I know you can't tell me for sure one way or another, but I imagine Madripoor is a kind of location that Marvel would at least want the option to revisit in a future film, right? Or a future TV show. It's one of their iconic locations from the comics. So without confirming or denying whether or not this is going to be in some other show or film, when it's something like that, when it's a Madripoor,
Is that a different level of conversation where you need to have all of Marvel sign off on like, yeah, we are really happy with this look that we could pull forward into this franchise if we wanted to?
I don't think they ever have a conversation like that, because they really look to how it sits within the story you're telling.
Okay.
So I don't know that they whether they have future plans or not, I wouldn't know. But I think they only look at the immediate and say, make it the best you can make it and make it the most evocative you can make it. And, you know, put together something that we haven't seen before that's you know, pulled from the comics, but isn't duplicating what the, you know, is improving what the comics are, not duplicating what the comics are.
Right.
And then I guess if we're lucky enough that we've dazzled, then they would probably use it again. I don't know. But that's all. So as far as I know, there's never those conversations. It's really just about how does it, you know, make it great for now, mm-hmm. for what we're doing.
Yeah.
And the rest will take care of itself.
Gotcha. All right. I want to talk about the Sharon shipping container fight because I loved this fight so much. I'm a big Sharon Carter fan. And I was, yeah. And I'm just like, so I think everyone was just so thrilled to watch her just sort of clean up in this fight. I'm curious, you know, it's tough. It's one person against a bunch of mercenaries here, a bunch of bounty hunters, whatever you might call it.
Okay, I can say that was my idea. In part, it was because I literally said, okay, guys, how many people are you going to put in this room with Nagel? I've got like four actors and Nagel. We can't have Sharon in there because that's too many people. And so what can we have her do? And I said, hey, what about if she's off, you know, let's make it that all these people are trying to get in there and she's like Atomic Blonde. She's able to, you know, hold the enemy at the gates, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted it to have an Atomic Blonde quality to the fighting, that it was much grittier and not, didn't feel choreographed, felt one take-ish, you know, where it all happens in front of you and the transition, you know, any, and she did most of her own work. I have to say she really rehearsed and trained for months to do those sequences. So there's very little stunt work in there. There is some, but very little, and you'd be hard pressed to find it. So that was the goal, so that it really felt, you know, kick-ass, female kick-ass, and no cuts, no
way. Yeah, yeah. No, there's one sequence where I was sure it was a stunt double because she had her hood pulled up, and I was like, okay, there's the stunt double. And then she turned, and it was Emily Van Camp's face, and I was like, no, that's Emily. It's still her. Yep. She's doing it. Yep. So, yep. Yeah, it's great.
No, it was her. Yeah, she was doing it. Yeah. She was doing it. No, really, she was. And so I'm very proud that that she was able to, you know, not get hurt, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the other thing. You know, you put an actor through some of this stuff and you're terrified that they're going to, you know, because, of course, they're in the moment. And she really threw herself into those sequences. But that's how people get hurt. So anyway, she managed it. We had a very safe stunt team. So they managed to keep her safe, and she managed to just pull off the badass of it. So it was great. So yeah, it was really fun to imagine that. And then the sort of the banter back and forth, guys, you better pick it up in there.
You mentioned, yeah, it's funny you mentioned Atomic Blonde because I know that Charlize has had to have like multiple dental surgeries after like her stunt heavy work that she's done, just because that's the toll it can take on the body. You know what I mean? I wanted to ask you about something that Nate said to me, and it was something that I was pretty sure was true, was one of the inspirations for this show in the first place was the natural chemistry that Anthony and Sebastian have on their various press tours. If you watch their various press tours, they're just sort of really giving it to each other back and forth and stuff like that. How do you try to translate that chemistry into a more scripted environment? And especially, I would say, a challenge in that is that while Anthony and Sam are pretty close, Sebastian and Bucky there's a wider distance between those two personalities. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you try to capture that natural in the wild chemistry and put it into this scripted environment?
Well, the first thing we did was in the writer's room, we watched a lot of their interviews so that we could really, study it and see how in the natural environment it worked. What was the nature of it by who had the quips, who was the straight guy, who was mm-hmm. how did it just work between them?
Yeah.
And because my feeling is you don't try and put a square peg in a round hole. And so it was really building on what was already there and saying, okay, these are the strengths and weaknesses of it. So let's build on that. And because we were in such a grounded world and Bucky, we were meeting Bucky now, the new Bucky, the guy that was no longer servicing a mind control situation and was in therapy and, you know, had come some distance. We were able to evolve Bucky a little bit into the space that would be more fun to watch him, you know, be the pitcher and the catcher of these individual jokes and the banter of it. Then the other thing we did, or I guess I did on the floor, was a lot of ad lib and let them riff. We really tried to capture. So the script, while yes, we had a script to go back to, mm-hmm. and because obviously mm-hmm. you have to protect the story of it, I did a lot of improv with them. We did a lot of improv even in reading the script. So in rehearsals, we would capture what the improv was and then put it, you know, bake it back into the script. But then even on the day, things would change and we were really encouraging them to be, you know, to freeform wherever possible. And they did. And so a lot of their work is, genuine banter in the moment.
I don't know if you saw this trending on Twitter today, after Daniel Brühl gave an interview to Entertainment Weekly, I believe, about the extended dance sequence that he did. And I saw the hashtag release the Zemo cut was trending. Can you talk to me at all about Daniel Brühl's dancing on the set there?
Oh,
that
so
day?
Funny. Just before this interview, I got these texts from Daniel going, "Oh my God, they love Zemo. I'm so happy." And I didn't know. You just told me why. I was like, I hadn't seen it. So, okay. We had so much fun. So it turns out Daniel as a person is incredibly funny. And he's a wonderful sense of humor and a real gentleman. And so we got into the idea of this club and the bar. Was really, I wanted to take the characters and see them in some downtime, I wanted to get to know them in a different environment that had maybe was, you know, sexy and see them in a different costume and my whole goal was to get Sebastian in some form of a tux. Same with Anthony, some form of, I just wanted to see them, you know, as the other side to their character. Mm-hmm. And same with Zemo, because in a place where they were so yanked out of their main line, you know, they could in fact enjoy each other. And for example, you know, when Zemo says trouble, that was pure Daniel just in the moment. And I said, "Oh my God, we have got to use that." And so when we got into the nightclub of it, they were, you know, I just had them doing some stuff and he just was rocking on by himself there. And we just captured it on film. And we just thought it was the funniest and most fun moment that we could come up with he could have possibly come up with to see Zemo so different. That explains why Daniel was texting me a few minutes ago.
Yes, he's officially a meme now. They love the dancing. They want more of it. So, thank you for giving us that gift.
Well, I'm gonna text him back now and say, okay, I want lessons.
Excellent.
Anthony Breznican, if you thought all the gunplay last week was a dark turn for the MCU, how do you feel about blood dripping off of Captain America's shield?
Oh, my God. even the music, even the closing credits music for this episode was more subdued, and it was like, oh, no. Like, it was shook. I have to say, I think that's the most disturbing image in MCU history. Are we agreed on that?
Well, I mean, let's see. I think, like, the most disturbing closing image, right? Because, like, I think there have been moments like, I don't know, Natasha's, I was like, Natalie's long for Nat, right? No, Natasha's death, Endgame, or, like, that vision in Ultron where everyone's sort of, like, broken and dead that Tony has. And if like, an episode ended with that, you would be disturbed, but then it, like, goes on to wrap up in a more optimistic way. So more than anything, I mean, yes, it ranks right up there with anything we've ever seen, but also more than anything, it's the fact that it's what we're left with for a week, sitting with that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. You and I are usually lockstep. I think this overshoots all of those. Like, Natasha's death was sad. It's heartbreaking, but it's also like a noble sacrifice, and it was her choice.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, like the when everybody's decimated in that vision that you just described. Yeah, but that's almost more Halloween-y. This was a guy who, I mean, did he decapitate him?
I think he did. Not to sound too gross or anything like that, but I zoomed in on the, like, you know, there's a wide shot of him. Because I wasn't sure if he was decapitated or if he had sort of caved his chest in. Both equally fun options. But I zoomed in on the wide shot and his chest looked intact to me. So I think that is a decapitation from Cap.
And
Cap. Yeah.
I think it's massively disturbing.
It's awful. Yeah.
And, like, he was already on the way to being, I mean, he was already a jerk, right? I mean, there's other words we could use for him.
Mm-hmm.
But in this episode, boy, they began dialing that volume up and they never stopped dialing. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife and I were watching it and we're like, does John Walker know about this fancy new invention called a doorknob? Because every time he enters a room, he, like, smashes through the door rather than opening it. Like, he just kicks it in or bashes it in. And we started laughing at a certain point because he just crashes in every single time. He's like Kool-Aid Man, you know? Like,
oh, no.
Oh, no. you know?
Yeah.
He's so rude, and he's such a jackass. And obviously, even before he gets the super soldier serum, and you know, when he enters for that final battle with Carly, and he's got the shield and the gun, it's the gun on top of the shield where I'm like, ugh, this is so disturbing already. And then poor Battlestar, poor Lamar gets, I mean, do we believe he's dead?
I think so,
right? Because they kept cutting back to his body during the chase. And I was like, is he going to open his eyes? And this is going to be like a Romeo and Juliet thing where he thinks he was killed, but he's actually okay. And, like, but I gather that he's actually dead.
Yeah.
Like, he was just so horrible throughout this. And I just feel like Malcolm did a really great job creating a human version of the worst of America. Like, if Steve Rogers is the best, if he represents our ideals, I think this guy just represents our worst. This guy is Abu Ghraib. This guy is enhanced interrogation. This guy is, I mean, I don't want to inflame people, but Derek Chauvin, that's what that final scene reminded me of.
No, absolutely. Everyone with their cell phones out, I think, is supposed to be an invocation of police brutality, you know?
I mean, without question, it's just, but also not just brutality, but murder. He murdered that man. And Derek Chauvin did too. And, like, it's and they did it in not just in front of people, but almost in spite of people. So I found it so disturbing. That's why I can't get over it. That final scene with the blood, you know, my wife and I were talking, like, we've been watching this show with the kids. How do we deal with this scene? It's a little much for them.
It's a lot. It's a lot. I'll be really interested to see. I would be interested to hear from parents. Once again, I don't want to sound like a pearl-clutching conservative. You know what I mean? Like, plenty of kids can handle plenty of things and stuff like that. But, like, I'd be interested to hear from parents stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, like, if you're struggling with this, with your kids watching this, you know?
Like, I think this is PG-13, right? Yeah. So I think, like, there are different levels of being a kid. Like, my daughter is pushing 12, and I think that's heavy for her, maybe. Just, and every kid is different, too.
Every
Their sensibilities
kid is different.
Are different.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
My 8-year-old son, like, I don't know if – I think we might – that's just a lot for him, you know? And but I think it's – you know, I'm really glad – I also don't want to sound like I'm criticizing this scene. I'm really glad they had that final shot. A shot from below. Mm-hmm. You're actually looking from the perspective of the victim there.
Mm-hmm.
And that American symbol on that shield that we know, and there's the quote-unquote Captain America behind it, and it's dripping with blood. And I just think that's a ballsy, brave, I think a courageous image to show, because I think the impulse with Marvel so often is, we're going to destroy a whole country, but you're never going to see a drop of blood, you know, unless it's like a little bit running from the corner of the hero's mouth to show that he, really took it on the chin, or she.
One careful cut along the cheekbone that really highlights the angular features.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, a little blood from the ear, which he does have, what John Walker does have coming out of his cowl. But I think this really shows the consequences, and we talk a lot about that, right? Show the repercussions of these actions. And it isn't just that he banged his shield and killed a guy. We see the death. We don't have to see the head flying off and the tendons ripping, but we see the blood, and it is gruesome. I thought it was really powerful.
Yeah. There's something – I wanted to go back to something you said about John Walker kicking down doors. I think a sequence that's done really well in this episode is John discovering his powers during the fight, right?
Mm-hmm.
He first realizes it as he kicks that door open. I mean, he kicked other doors open, but this is it. Like, the glass shatters as he kicks the door open. And then he throws his shield, and the shield gets stuck in the wall or the pillar, and then he can pull it out. And he's like, oh, you know, you could just, like, Wyatt Russell silently is showing us someone coming to grips with their power. And then he, you know, he bends the bar and, like, all this sort of stuff along throughout the fight, discovering the limits of his power, or the lack of limits of his power. Mm-hmm. And I went back and I rewatched, we talked about it before, but that
Audrey's bridal scene in Captain America.
Exactly. Like, I rewatched that scene where Steve is chasing down Richard Armitage, who has just killed Erskine. And Steve, in that moment, you know, you had talked in an earlier episode about how they got a runner to double him. He had fake rubber feet on, all this stuff like that. But what really stands out, if you watch those two scenes back to back, is how Steve is just like, sorry, 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 like crashing into a window, running into a car, like, sorry, 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 sorry. And just like, appalled.
Literally doesn't know his own strength.
Yeah, doesn't know his own strength, but is like appalled, you know, and embarrassed by, like, how, you know, as opposed to John just sort of gleefully soaking up his extra, like, strength here. You know what I mean?
The difference between a hero and a villain, really.
I
was there when my little humble brag was, I watched him crash through the window of the bridal shop in that original movie. And it's like, it's very funny, but it's also like, whoops. You know? Watching him come to power was really scary, and you realize that Carly Morgenthau is not the big bad of this series, that she's an antagonist, and she's questionable. But there's, you know, I love the scene between her and Sam yeah. where they actually, and I was watching it and I was like, Joanna will like this scene because it's not punching. This is quiet scene that Joanna likes.
It's like, true. It's
tailor made for you.
It's true. I do like people in rooms talking. I'm a big fan of it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
How does that final scene make you feel about the shield? Because there's this whole debate, right, of Sam saying maybe it should be destroyed and Bucky being like, no, that's what stands for Steve. Like, how do you feel about the shield?
Carly says that too, that they should have destroyed the shield, uh-huh. which is interesting. I think what's interesting is we see literal blood on the shield here, but I think what we're going to find, you know, what Nate Moore said in his interview with me is that, you know, there's more to come with Isaiah. And we've been thinking about whether or not we were going to see like Isaiah's backstory and stuff like that. And that is about a metaphorical blood on the shield, right? Mm-hmm. The yes. story of Isaiah Bradley. And so I just think that like, and it, you know, it harkens back too to some of the things that Malcolm said, which is just Malcolm Spellman, which is just about like trying to complicate. This show is about trying to complicate the legacy of that symbol, and in mm-hmm. and by doing so, complicate the Augie apple pie legacy of America, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, my feelings changed about it. Mm-hmm. Like after that, I'm like, that's a murder weapon. I'm sure it was used many times to kill really bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's worth noting too, like Steve Rogers carried like Captain America. His Captain America was equipped with a shield. That was his quote unquote weapon, not a gun or any other thing. It was what he used to do his hero work was a shield, not a weapon, really. And I think there's a difference there, right? And this guy goes around with a gun perched on top of that shield, and now he's used it as an actual murder weapon.
Yeah.
And it just, it reminded me of this feeling I've had for a while that you can have a lot of good, you can do a lot of good, but then all of that can really easily be undone. You know, I think our country is the same way, right? Not to get on a soapbox or anything, but like you can make progress for a long time. Where things feel like they're getting more equitable, where people are learning a little more about how to be kind to each other, how to be sensitive, or how to be more accepting. And yet all of that progress over decades can be undone much more easily than that progress was constructed. You know, so you elect somebody who's got fascist tendencies or a bigoted worldview and, to a top leadership position, and all of a sudden it just – the house of cards falls, right? And that's what this reminded me of, is just you can spend years trying to repair something or trying to heal something, and then it's very easy to cut it open again. And to me, I'm like, you know what, maybe that shield should be destroyed, and we remember the good that it stood for, and you know, now it's part of a crime scene. I don't know. I'm really upset by this final shot. Anyway,
I don't know.
So like, what do you think? Does it change your feeling?
I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to it. I don't know that I would want to see it gone. I might want to see it painted differently or something like that. Do you know what
how,
I mean?
How like, do you purify something like
that? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it just has more to do with the man wielding it than anything else. I am still really okay. So let me ask you a Zemo question, Anthony. The Zemo escapes via the bathroom, the Dora Milaje right on his heels. Where do you think he goes next?
Where does Zemo go? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know the answer to that, but he did a very interesting thing in this episode, didn't he? When he had access to the super soldier mm-hmm. serum. I thought for sure he was going to inject that right away. And
oh, really?
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is his chance. This is the secret reason he wants to, quote unquote, stop the super soldiers. Like, he wants it. And he looked at it and he shattered it all.
Yeah.
And,
Well, but that's his whole thing. His whole thing is he's anti-super soldier serum.
Right.
Like, but and how, I think...
How often are people against something that they're secretly for?
Okay, know, for okay, fair enough. Right? Yeah. So, I think that...
So where do you think he's headed?
Well, I just think that, like, you know, and I said this to Richard, but I just think that, like, anything that, anything with super soldier serum in it, meaning Bucky, Isaiah, the Flag Smashers, John Walker, are not safe around Zemo. He says in episode three, he says, "I don't mean to leave my work unfinished," right? And he's talking about trying to dismantle the super soldier program. And so I feel like Zemo's mission, no matter what, is eradicate everything super soldier serum. That's all he cares about. And he's making nice and he's giving Turkish delight to children and he's part of fun dancing memes and stuff like that. But we should always be watching Zemo, I think. So,
What do you make of the Turkish delight? Is there a little bit of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe there?
A little Narnia, maybe, I guess, but... you know, further reason to distress him if he's white witching that Turkish delight out there. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah.
That's what that reminded me of.
Yeah.
Also,
for sure.
Turkish delight. I'm sorry. Are we going to get bad letters
if
I say it's disgusting?
It's
disgusting. Yes. It's horrible.
It's disgusting. It is.
Is that us, like Americans raised on Nerds candy, I mean, and Kit Kats? Like,
maybe some people love Turkish delight, but an experience of almost any person I've ever met is reading the Narnia books, getting really excited about trying Turkish delight, and then trying it and going like, oh Jesus Christ. So yeah,
I remember getting up like when that movie came out way back in the day, and they sent a little package of Turkish delight as like a promo item, like, ooh, I've never tried this.
It's not great. All right, what else do we want to talk about?
I always think of Afternoon Delight, too, and it's just a bad call.
But yeah, I mean, they have, like, you know, the Zemo singing Ba Ba Black Sheep and, like, doing that, like, responding to that stupid head tilt line, like, straightening his head and stuff like that. Like, I think they're really trying to get us to lower our defenses about Zemo. But go ahead.
Did you notice that when John Walker spotted the one remaining super soldier serum, that he cocked his head like Zemo?
Oh, I didn't pick that up. That's beautiful.
Yeah, he did the head tilt. I'm like, oh, that's why they pointed that out. It wasn't just a joke.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Star of David motif that we saw in the stained glass in the apartment where they're staying. And also it was in the pattern of the tile on the floor of the warehouse. And they mentioned Nazis a couple times in this. And I'm always a little wary. Whenever they mention something twice in an episode, it feels like it's going to show up two episodes later. So, like, I got worried about, like, Zola or the Red Skull or something like that, right? Like, they mention Wakanda and then Wakanda shows up. Or they mention Sharon and then Sharon shows up. So they mention Nazis a couple times. So I don't know if that's, like, foreshadowing something or if... it's a nod to the comics where the character of Bucky Barnes in the MCU is a combination character, right? He's Bucky Barnes, but he's also Arnie Roth, Cap's older friend who protected Steve. And that character is canonically Jewish and actually canonically gay. And so I didn't know if they were like, probably what happened is they saw a beautiful location with a beautiful stained glass window, and I'm reading too much into it. But there are, like, frame shots of Bucky with, like, you know, Star of David all around him, and I just thought that that was interesting. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, I noticed that too. I mean, it's the shape of a Star of David. I think an actual Star of David has the lines, and these were just sort of the outline. So I don't know enough about that symbolism to know, like, oh, that doesn't count or it does count. But I do know that all of those scenes, this whole episode was set in Riga, Latvia. And Riga was the site of, I mean, it was occupied by the Nazis, and it was the site of a Jewish ghetto when they were all rounded up and forced to live there. So I don't know that perhaps they didn't choose that location by accident.
So perhaps... you know, what is intended here is more of a nod towards the conversations around supremacy and sort of like Ubermensch's and Zemo's, staunch anti-supremacy stance, something we can probably agree on. And his sense that, like,
yes, Carly has this conversation with Sam, but she's still like kind of threatening his family, right? And there still is this idea of like, once you become powerful, and not only powerful, but then like we see that she has the, you know, the fanny pack of vials, like it's going to be, you know, before they were smashed, it was going to be her choice who to super up, you know what I mean? And that in and of itself is, you know, that's too much power for one person to have, right?
I think this is all really insightful. Yeah, I think it's human nature across the board to, you know, when you push back against something that you find oppressive or evil, it's very easy to match that.
Yeah.
You know, fight fire with fire, and then you become like the thing you're resisting mm-hmm. without even meaning to. I think it's like you see whole countries do this. You see this happen in school where the little freshman graduates to becoming a upper class person and suddenly takes on the characteristics of the bullies.
Yeah.
Takes on the oppressive, sexist, misogynist, bigoted points of view as a kid gets older. Instead of learning to resist that, the abuser, you know, an abused child, physically abused, often becomes an abuser later. And I think one of my favorite characters in history is Robespierre, because he was this wonderful lawyer, a champion for the underprivileged who mm-hmm. represented them against the aristocracy and against the wealthy. And then the French Revolution happens and suddenly everybody's like, oh, Robespierre, yeah, he's a good dude. He looked out for us. Like, let's make him one of our leaders. And he just like unleashes vengeance on people, not just those who deserve it, but then kept going and punishing those who just were sort of adjacent to those who deserve extreme punishment or to be held accountable. And his punishments were maybe didn't fit the crime so much. And then his associates began to be walked to the guillotine because they were not in favor of him enough. And finally, his story ends with you know, the tragic thing is that he just wanted to unite France. And finally, his fellow leaders post-revolution are like, you know, we got to get rid of Robespierre because he's going to get rid of us. And when he was marched to the guillotine,
yeah,
he stands there and looks out, and it's the biggest crowd they've ever had. He has united people in their fear and hatred of him. So wow. In a way, he succeeds, but by becoming even worse than the thing he fought against. So yeah. I've always found that to be instructive. Like, you know, when I'm very strident politically, you know, strong point of views, but like, I'm always trying to put a hand on my own shoulder and be like, okay, don't become like the trolls. Don't become like the people you're resisting. And I think that's why I asked about the beheading, because I was kind of like, is this like a guillotine? Is this like the French Revolution went too far? A little bit of reference there, like that history thrown in, a little bit of the Riga history with the Jewish ghetto and the Nazis thrown in. And I don't know. Maybe we're reading too much into it, but I think Malcolm Spellman gave this a lot of thought. And I think he put things in there for us to maybe uncover. What do you think?
No, definitely. I mean, I think
that's a lot of Robespierre I just forced on you.
Love a Robespierre. Did you know that I have a Scarlet Pimpernel tattoo?
No.
Yes, I do. It's. I mean, the intention of the series is to not give us any one villain that is mustache twirling in a way that we can't reach them on some level. Even John Walker, who is definitely beyond the pale here, they give us that locker room scene. Even Carly, who blew up a building with people inside of it last week, we're still given sympathetic conversations with. Zemo, whatever he may wind up trying to do, you know, all this sort of stuff, like that's the show they're trying to do. The Killmonger was right show. Sometimes more successfully, in some places more successfully than others, but that's their attempt, right?
They did it with a little cafe scene between Lamar, Battlestar, and John Walker too, where he's like, would you take it? And I was like, oh, he hasn't, he like injected it yet. And maybe he already had.
but he was questioning it, and maybe there's hope for him, and then no.
No hope.
I think he hadn't. I think Lamar being his, like, conscience in his head and being, like, and giving him that affirmation of, like, you always make the right choice in the heat of battle, and then we see that he doesn't. But, and it'll be interesting to see if we I don't know. There's only two episodes left, so it's hard to know what they have time for. But, you know, he mentions, like, earning those medals from the worst day of his life. Are we going to see that day? Are we going to see, like, what happened in Afghanistan to make John Walker a quote-unquote hero? That might be interesting. Once again, there's only two episodes left, so I don't know. But the other thing they need to get to in all of this is that in the trailers, there's, like, there appears to be some sort of G20 summit terror attack still coming. I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. So you know how in the closing credits, there are, we've talked about this before, I think, but there are title cards that are placeholders. And if someone's in the episode, their name is in there. And if they're not, it's not. Do you know what I mean?
Right? Yes. Sharon Carter was that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Florence Kasumba had one until she showed up, et cetera, et cetera. Daniel Brühl had one until he showed up. There's, like, the image is there, but the name isn't there. So after Daniel Brühl, there's, you know, after the Zemo title card or credit card, there's one more after it that we still haven't seen filled in yet. And it the background on it is the GRC logo. So my question is, are we going to see someone associated with the GRC who is going to show up in one of these last two episodes? Maybe the person running the GRC, maybe the GRC is somehow corrupt and associated with the power broker. Maybe whoever's running the GRC is the power broker. Questions, question mark, question mark, question mark. But I have a theory, and I want to hear your any theory you might have first.
I don't have a theory, so let's hear yours.
I'm going to go with Thunderbolt Ross.
Oh,
William
okay.
Hurt. William Hurt, maybe. There's also possibly an... I don't want to get us too far down the WandaVision path, but there is reportedly someone in this cast who is not leaked out yet who they are. There is reportedly an actor coming. What role that actor will be playing, I don't know. But
we're engineer.
It's Al Pacino as the engineer, who also runs the GRC and is the power broker. You know. So yeah, I don't know. I'm episode 5 is the episode that, like, Malcolm Spellman has said he's excited for, Nate Moore said he was excited for, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, I, you know, all eyes on the prize next week. We'll see what comes of it. But yeah, there's still some big stuff left to come. Obviously,
I think
you know.
You're right. I mean, I think that's a very good guess. Thunderbolt Ross would be an excellent, I mean, and very likely.
I mean, maybe. I mean, the idea, we talked last week about this idea of the Thunderbolts, this, like, group of villains or antiheroes. You could see John Walker and Zemo and maybe some other people being a part of that. And especially, like, Ross has, from his introduction in the MCU in Hulk, been associated with the Super Soldier Serum, right?
Oh, yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. So, like, if someone were interested in making more Super Soldier Serum, someone who has a lot of opinions about superhero supremacy, as we found out in Captain America Civil War, it might be Ross, you know? So where are you, leaving wild speculation aside, where are you with, is Sharon Carter the power broker this week?
I don't know. We didn't get too much of her, but she's got some resources, man. When Sam says, have your eye in the sky, keep watch over Walker, I was like, wow, She summons a lot of material to her cause. She's not just some loner out in the world. So, I don't know. Maybe.
Could be. Or working for the power broker, or working, or pretending to work for the power broker, but still undercover for the CIA, you know? Like, well, let me ask this. Because they haven't given us the answer one way or another. What do you feel like would be most emotionally satisfying for a character like Sharon? Like, what would you most like to see come of her character?
I think the thing we were just discussing, which is that tilt into villainy, where somebody's trying to do right, but they end up going wrong. To me, that's the most interesting thing that could happen with her. What do you think?
I don't know. I think I want to see her get the drop on someone very important. So I'm kind of into the idea of she's pretending and still in league with the CIA.
Hmm.
That's what I... Not that the CIA has its hands clean, but like...
Yeah,
the good guys. The good guys. But that she... I want Sharon always on the up and up. So I would like to see... I would like to see all of this like an elaborate cover.
One vote for Do the Right Thing, one vote for Breaking Bad.
Okay. Sounds good. Anything else you want to talk? I mean, there's obviously like a lot that happened, but we're also
that in
sort
the
of,
sense of she should do the right thing, not the movie do the right thing.
But we're smack dab in the middle of the series, so like you know, it's all guesswork now, but like, do you have any like anything else this episode revealed to you that you want to talk about?
Yeah, if you don't, the thing I wonder is like, if you're making a mystery out of who the power broker is, then you better satisfy that mystery in some way, you know, either with, oh, it's somebody who's in the cast that we've been hanging with for a while, or it's somebody we recognize. Like, you only build up a little surprise if you've got a payoff. So it can't just be, it's just some random guy. I think that was the problem that maybe inadvertently developed with WandaVision, is they're like, ah, I've got an engineer friend. And everybody's like, ooh, who could that be? And then it turns out just to be not anyone of consequence, you know. Why was that generated as a mystery? And it turns out it wasn't intended as a mystery. It was just not, they didn't identify the person because it wasn't anyone recognizable. So,
right. Don't give us another engineer. No offense to that part of the story, but give us either Al Pacino as the head of CIA or Sharon Carter. I definitely don't think it's Zemo at this point. Because Zemo's whole thing is destroying the super soldier serum. So there's not a lot of other options as to who it could be in terms of people we've already seen in the cast, right? So I got my eye on that suspiciously blank title card, and I'm hoping it's either filled out with William Hurt's name or someone else really dazzling. I'll be interested to see. Anything else you want to talk about?
I'm still stunned into silence by that closing shot, but I think we covered it.
Yeah. Equally devastating that the man who's killed by the shield was a fan of Captain America as a kid. Sad.
Right?
Yeah.
Killed by that shield.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we should talk about the Dora Milaje and that great battle sequence.
Yes.
In the apartment.
Yeah, incredible stuff. I loved seeing them. Like, it's been a while, because even though they're technically in Infinity War, we don't, you know, other than Okoye Denai Guerrero's character, we didn't really get to see them, like, really, really go at it. And it was just such fun to see them be so good at their jobs. What did you think?
I thought they were fantastic, and I thought it was not just beautifully choreographed, the stunt work, the fight sequences. Like, sometimes with fight sequences, it all feels a little like sometimes the Pirates of the Caribbean movies felt this way to me, like too choreographed, too much ballet and not much threat. And man, when the Dora Milaje are fighting, I don't expect that they're going to kill anyone or like that this is going to be the end of a character, but like you feel the hit, right? You feel the blunt end of those, are they spears? Or I know they're high-tech weapons that are beyond just spears, but like the point and the blunt end of that, the staffs they're using to just take these guys down. And I thought it also had a lot of political significance, the way John Walker responds to this, to being bested.
Oh, yeah.
They don't even have... What does he say? They're not even superhuman, or they're not...
They don't even have the serum.
They don't even have the serum. Mm-hmm. And to me, it reminded me of every incel online who, like, you know, everybody deals with trolls, but I think women and people of color deal with it disproportionately. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because people like that are more angry when they are bested by somebody they consider to be beneath them.
Yeah.
And I thought you saw a little flash of his misogyny and probably some racism in John Walker when he was like, these fantastic black women who are warriors bested me. They took me out, and they, I think you see bitterness in him, not just anger at being defeated, but like a chip on the shoulder. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no, 1,000%. And look better with a shield than I do.
Oh, then she takes his shield. Like she just totally stomps on it and catches it in the way that Steve Rogers did. Yeah, that was great.
A total Steve move that nothing we've ever seen from John. I completely agree with your interpretation of that moment. I thought it was really good. And something that we should shout out is that, you know, in my conversation with Carrie Scoglin, the director, she mentioned to me, and this actually ties back into the Sharon Powerbrooker thing. I forgot to mention this. I'm glad we are back on this track. She told me that it was her idea in the last episode for Sharon Carter to not go into the shipping container, but to stay outside and fight a bunch of people. And Carrie's, like, if you look at Carrie's, you know, filmography, you know, and the TV stuff that she's done, she's really interested in, like, highlighting the strength of women. That is something that she is very interested in her career. And so the fact that it was, like, her idea for Sharon Carter to just clean up in the last week's episode, and the fact that she directed the Dora Milaje similarly cleaning up in this episode, I think just sort of speaks to something that she's interested in depicting. And something that I really valued about that is that, I mean, I think we saw it in Black Panther, but oftentimes in the MCU and in action films at large, women are often only allowed to fight other women. You know, you see that in Infinity War. You have to have a female henchman for Thanos that the women have someone to fight. You know what I mean? It's just often like women are paired up with women. And so watching these women take on these four dudes handily, easily, was really incredible.
It was. And I think the move where she's like, beep, boop, bop, like, and disconnects Winter Soldier's arm. Like, I like that because it was like, and I also love that she called him White Wolf at the beginning.
Yeah.
And
James.
But to me, that was, I'm not going to hurt you, but because I'm choosing not to.
Yeah. Like, you're lucky I've decided not to hurt you at this moment.
I am, in this case, literally disarming you.
Yeah.
So why don't you just back off? And I thought that was funny, and I also like the way, you know, he got in, I think maybe a little bit unintentionally got into that fracas and then kind of, you know, wanted to chill it out, de-escalate a little bit. But I really had to laugh at Zemo just sipping his whiskey, like standing back, like he didn't do a dance, but it was almost like watching them all fight, just sort of like, this is fun. He was quite enjoying that spectacle. And I think the difference between how Sam and Bucky responded to that versus how U.S. agent responded, how John Walker responded, it really highlighted John Walker's mediocrity.
Yeah, his petulance. You know, yeah.
Is that he was bested. And
right. Because, I mean, Sam says something basically like, you don't want to mess with these women, like, like out of respect. Like, Sam respects them. We know that Bucky respects them. And like, when Bucky's like reattaching his arm and sort of like, what, he's not like, it's not
arm fall off boy.
Yeah, but he's not like, I can't believe I was bested by a girl. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of like, damn it. Well, that's something my arm can do, apparently. Also, that move reminded me a lot of, I don't know if you ever watched Xena Warrior Princess, but Xena Warrior Princess was forever using pressure points on the body to like paralyze people while she fought them. That's what it reminded me of.
So. It's like smiting, fighting smarter rather than harder, you know. Like.
Exactly. But to that other point about it being the director's choice to remove Sharon from the shipping container. And the reason that she gave is that there were just too many people in the lab and she needed to have someone outside the lab, so she decided to be Sharon. Mm. I was using Sharon not going into the shipping container as like a big clue that she might be the power broker.
Mm.
And the fact that it was less about that and more about Carrie being like, this space is too tight for this many people, put her outside.
Or she might be, serving you a little red herring there.
Oh, she might. She always, they can always be leading me by the nose.
No. She didn't go in because that scientist would have recognized her.
That's not the question I asked her. I didn't say, why didn't Sharon go into the shipping container? I said, I loved Sharon's fight. And she said, well, that was my idea. She offered it. The only reason why I think it might not be a deflection. But it might. But, she might be playing four-dimensional chess. I get best at four-dimensional chess all the time. So
the listeners have an advantage because I haven't heard your interview.
It's true, even though
I'm following it.
Here we are. This, I will say, overall, this show is still like a little wonky to me in tone shifting, but something that Nate Moore said in my interview with him is that episode 5 is where he feels like all the pieces start to slide into place together. All these things that feel a little disparate might feel unified in episode 5. And so he was like, episode 4 might be the one that gets a lot of people talking. He's like, because of a certain heel turn. And I guess he was talking about what John Walker does. But for him and for Malcolm Spellman, episode 5 is the one they're really excited for people to watch. So, therefore, I am really excited to watch it, and see what comes next. All right. Anything else we want to mention before we go?
I think that covers it.
I think we did it, Anthony. Good job, us. All right. We will see you here back next week. Until then, Anthony Breskin, where can folks find your great work?
You can hear me going on and on at allaboutrobespierre.net and at vanityfair.com.
You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Anthony's got some great stuff up on VF.com, so I really do encourage that you check it out. And we will be back here next week. Bye.
Bye.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.